Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.
Hi, Jim Potts back on the air, and as always, thank you so much for sharing your Sunday with me. Well, today I've got a number of things that I want to talk about. There was a lot of things in the news this week that I think that deserve some attention. I will be talking about finalizing this business about the most notorious serial killers. I got a couple that were left from last week that I want to talk about, who were the worst of the worst, I guess you could call them. And then I'm also going to be talking about a number of the most notorious female serial killers as well. Some of this you'd just be shocked at. But before we get into that, I got to address some other issues that came up this week, because you know I'm going to be talking about emails. I always like to read the emails, so I'll be doing that. But before we do that, I got to tell you, I saw something on the news that was very alarming, and that has to do with the Texas school district. Now, you might remember about a year ago, it was in June, actually, of last year, at the Santa Fe High School, there was a 17-year-old gunman that killed 10 people. Well, the community and the school district has now had a knee-jerk reaction to that. And look, I've got no issue with reactions, so to speak, but one of the things I always talk about is how we let sometimes our emotions take over. And to me, emotions sometimes can make for bad decisions when we let our emotions get out of control. Well, the Texas school district that has to do with the Santa Fe High School there, they're arming their guards with AR-15s. You heard me correctly. These are automatic rifles, and they're also using facial recognition and tracking students and staff with chip technology. Now, listen, I can understand that they want to amp up their security. I get that. But how far do we go with some of this when you really think about it? Arming their guards with AR-15s, installing facial recognition cameras, and tracking students with chip technology, tracking students. Hey, listen, let me tell you something. I don't know. I can only tell you my opinion that sometimes when people go, you know, over the top with some of this stuff, that you know what's going to happen. Somebody's going to take this. And I see lawsuits in the making. You start talking about tracking people, where does that lead to, big brother? But we'll see. I don't know. Now, I will tell you that the community is behind this. Now, the reason why they're behind it, and the rationale, by the way, was that every deputy in every school in that district is going to receive a gun. It's going an AR-15. It is going to be stored in a cold locked safe. So let me make that clear. They're going to have it in a code locked safe. All right. That's part of the new security system and also a part of the safety plan. Now, there's a difference here. Are they going to be walking around with these AR-15s in the event that something happens? Are they going to be pulling these AR-15s out of this locked safe? Because let me tell you something. A lot of these shootings, it's over in 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes at best. So suppose you're out of position, if nothing else, at the time that something goes down. You may not even have time to get there. Not to mention the fact, if it's a former student, which a lot of these are, or a current student, they're going to know the system. So the thought, though, of actually a school arming their people, their guards, with this, to me, I don't know. I just don't see that. Now, I will tell you the rationale of the superintendent. He says that these weapons are being purchased for their deputies, and that's the ones that's walking around, because he's a firm believer that they're going to fight firepower with super firepower, he's calling it. We're going to fight with firepower, and we're going to have the superior firepower. That's what he's saying. He's also saying that, look, we're going to try and do it to buy time. And by buying time and by having a deputy on campus, or multiple deputies on campus, That time allows our deputies to respond and do their job, he said, as part of the new measure. Like I said, these things happen very, very quickly. And do you want to get your staff relying on any one person or two people, whatever the case may be, to have to go to a locked safe, open up the safe, understanding that they may be somewhat nervous, get in there, get that weapon, and get out before it's all over? I don't know. I'm still an advocate that we have to prepare. We have to prepare. You know, forget having an AR-15 for a second. Why not do the training of the students, the training of the staff, be able to go down into lockdown procedures, et cetera? By the way, if anybody wants to comment on this, as usual, I always give my phone number, 818-602-4929. Again, that's 818-602-4929. Or you can always email me, as so many people do, listenup@pottsandassociates.com. That's listenup@pottsandassociates.com. And if you want to get on my blog list, by the way, on my email blast that I do about the upcoming show topics, just text POTS Associates and text that to 22828. So that's POTS Associates and text it to 22828 and then enter your email address. And it'll you'll get that every week. It'll tell you what the upcoming topics are. So, look, getting back to what I was saying, though. Here's what the superintendent also had to admit, though. He says nothing is stronger than having eyes and ears constantly on patrol on school grounds. He believes teachers are the best defense for any school. Now, see, that's what I'm talking about. So that's your first line of defense. This business with bringing all of a sudden bringing guns on campus like this, how many schools do we have in this country and how many incidents do we have in the course of a year? Think about it. One, maybe two. And sure, it's bad news if your school is the one. But that's why the schools need to have these other safety plans together, go through these things with drills, in my opinion, and rely on that and not relying on any one person with an AR-15. And excuse me, let me back up. That's not to say that they're only relying on that, in all fairness to them. All right? But like I said, this thing I've talked about on the show before, bringing guns onto school campuses, in my opinion, I just don't get with that. Now, the Texas City voters actually approved $6.5 million to beef up the safety and security measures in their schools. Okay, I get that. But again, that's an emotional reaction. You know, the superintendent turned around and said, you know what, we're not playing around. This isn't some kind of little game to us. We put a lot of time and money and effort into what he's proposing here. Now, that's fine. And let me just make it clear, it's the Texas City Independent School District. Now, in addition to that, is what they were talking about, is, you know, he commented, I think we're living in a sick society and there's some very deeply troubled people out there that want to do harm to our kids and to campuses and to teachers, and we're not going to let that happen. I fully agree with that. And parents in the community, they were very supportive of the safety crackdown. I think a lot of parents are very supportive of this. But I also think that you need a common sense approach and not an emotional knee-jerk reaction. You know, the school personnel have even said that for them it is a sense of security. Look, I get it. There's a lot of people out there that are very concerned about these things. I'm concerned about it. That's why I'm on the air talking about these things. But I'm also not an advocate of doing things that could actually end up being situations that we regret later. So, you know, all of the schools out there, and we've done a number of schools, as you are aware, I think I've talked about it before in the air, how we've done site assessments for schools. We went in the protocols and procedures and safety plans and put them in place, trained them from an active shooter standpoint. To me, nothing beats that. And I think that that's the game plan to stick with. And not getting out there and putting guns out there in the same environment as kids, especially like an automatic rifle. Because I'm telling you something, those automatic rifles, when they start spraying, all right, you better hope that you don't miss. And now all of a sudden, you're hitting kids. And yes, does that take some training? I would agree with that. But you just have no idea. Somebody is shooting at you. You're firing back. I don't know. The emotional part of it. Somebody could get caught up with these type of weapons on the campuses and things like that. And I'm sure not in favor of wondering where they're going to be going with this tracking students with chip technology. What is that? So, I don't know. We'll just wait and see how that turns out. Texas already had open carry laws down there, so it's already the Wild Wild West down there. I get that. But the realities are, I think they're going a little bit too far in that particular school district with something like this. So, at any rate, I just wanted to at least discuss that real quick because I don't think that's the way to go. We've talked about it on the show before, about teachers being armed. People have called in about teachers being armed, et cetera. And from the emails I get, most people support the fact that they don't think the teachers should be armed as well. Okay, well, that's that. Let's move on. Okay, first email. Jim, I was shocked to hear about the Coast Guard officer who wanted to kill Democrats and TV hosts. I see this situation as a cross between politics and domestic terrorism. Do you agree? Tim from Fort Worth, Texas. Yes, I do actually agree with that. It is a cross. And, you know, sometimes it's very, very difficult to be able to separate these things out. Most of the domestic terrorists out there, some of it's political, religious ideologies, racist-based ideologies, et cetera. And as you know, I don't discuss politics in terms of left or right, who's wrong. Let's just put it that way. But when you start talking about a Coast Guard officer who wanted to kill, I put him in the same category as I would put any, you know, deranged, you know, potential serial killer or whatever the case may be. And I don't care what his affiliation is. If he wanted to kill Democrats, I will assume that that meant that he's more of the on the Republican side and versus the Democratic side. But this also is not new. So what I'm going to talk about, first of all, I want to get in a little bit into this about this Coast Guard officer. For those of you that did not hear about this. So let's talk about this. Yeah, this guy was he's a U.S. Coast Guard lieutenant, and he's actually working in the nation's capital. But on the side, he was living a secret life as a domestic terrorist who aspired to do mass murder and compiled a target list of prominent politicians and journalists. Federal prosecutors are really going after this guy, as they should, in my opinion. Now, he was arrested. His name was Christopher Hassan, by the way. And he was arrested on the 15th of February. And when they arrested him, they're charging him with drug and gun charges. Now, there was a detention memo that said he intended to murder innocent civilians as well, and on a scale rarely seen in this country. I mean, here we go. This is totally deranged. Now, he's also previously espoused extremist views for years, apparently. And he's also read the manifesto. There's a manifesto out there by this guy by the name of Anders Breivik. And for those of you who do not know who he is, he was a Norwegian terrorist. He shot and killed 77 people way back in 2011. Wasn't here. But apparently this Hansen guy has followed this, you know, what this individual did. Now, let's talk about how the FBI got him, because I've mentioned on the show before about how our law enforcement agencies, they really are out there trying to head a lot of these things off, and they've really been successful. This particular individual, he had conducted online searches and made thousands of visits for pro-Russian, neo-fascism, and neo-Nazis literature. That's what he did. And this is a lot. I mean, thousands of visits on this. That tells me that's somebody that's obsessed just by the very number of that. And that, by the way, was only from January 2017 to January 2019. You're talking 2 years that this guy was at this. And apparently he also, there was an email that they found where he stated, "I'm dreaming of a way to kill almost every last person on the earth." That is sick. And one of the things that he was going to do, what they found on his computer, he was kind of noodling around, I guess, and said he thought that a plague would be the most successful, but he didn't know how to acquire the needed, you know, Spanish flu or botulism or anthrax. He wasn't sure how to get a hold of that, you know, those kind of chemicals, et cetera. Now, that just goes to show you that this guy is literally off the deep end. But I will tell you something. The people that are on the left out there are probably going to say, yeah, that's how these people are. You know, the right, you know, these people are very radical, you know, so I'm going to give both sides, okay? Because like I told you, I always want to be in the middle with this. So, you know, I want to call your attention back to something else that happened back in June of 2017. And for those of you who don't remember, that was June 14th, 2017, when they also had the Republicans that were out there getting ready for a baseball practice because it was a game that the politicians play every year. Now, it took place at Eugene Simpson Stadium Park. Some of you may remember that. It's in Alexandria, Virginia. Now, that's a bipartisan event that was first held in 1909. So that's just an annual event every year. And you might remember what happened. We had a shooter that came out there, and then he ended up shooting a number of the members of the team. Now, there was like a 10-minute shootout with all of this. And you look at that and say, okay, this is something that happens on both sides. So I don't want us out there thinking that this is something from one side versus the other. What we're talking about are individuals, to me, that are obsessed with their ideologies. We're in a political climate right now, in my opinion, where emotions run rampant. It's what I just talked about a moment ago with the Texas situation. Look, this all has to do with emotions. I talked about that with road rage, you know, the training of many of you know. You know, this thing about emotions, people have to stay in control of their emotions with all of this stuff. And this guy, to me, is clearly, well, I mean, I can't put it any other way. I'll say that these are all allegations because he hasn't been convicted of anything yet, so let me make that clear. But you're talking about a guy that's going to do all of this, and he was in the United States Coast Guard as a lieutenant? How did his ideologies even get past his superiors? It's just amazing to me. But the good news is the FBI did their job. They caught this guy. The shooter that was at this game, same thing. You guys have seen, I'm sure, on TV, these different politicians, one Scalise, who's now recovered from it, or still recovering from it, I should say. And it's insane. There's nothing else that I can say about that. But let's be honest, it's not just one side or another. People that want to do mass destruction like this, and this guy especially, if he's talking about he wants to kill as many people as possible, he wasn't just focusing on our Democrats. He may have had a list of people that he wanted to go after. I don't want to get into the names of the list because I don't think that's important. But the reality is that if he's talking about anthrax and some of these other, plagues of sorts that he could put out there, he was going to be killing people probably on both sides, not any one side, especially, you know, if he got quoted saying that he wanted to kill as many people as possible. This stuff is just deranged. At any rate, that was the first email that I got that I wanted to share with you. You know, so I wanted to be able to respond to that because I wanted to make sure that that Tim understands it's just not, with the Democrats he was going after, because there's other situations, first of all, where other people have done the same thing. So I don't want to put in any of those different categories like that, okay? Okay, let's move on. Tim, I hope I answered your question there. You know, and yes, I did agree that it's between politics and domestic terrorism. Okay, next one up. Jim, in reference to the Aurora shooter, the news said he lied about his background, and I think his name. This goes to show how easy it is to get a gun. Don't you think tighter controls are necessary and critical to our safety? Kimberly, Berkeley, California. Kimberly, yes, I do. And by the way, before I forget, last week on the show, I made a comment that the Aurora shooter, I think, was captured. He was not captured. He actually died at the scene. So I did want to correct that, because when I went back and listened to the show, I said, wait a minute, I think that he got killed. So I looked into that. So I just want to make sure I correct the record, so to speak. All right. Now, in reference to this Aurora shooter, Kimberly, you're absolutely right about one thing. He lied. And that's a problem. And we always talk about my gun control advocates out there, or my not my gun control advocates, just the opposite, the ones that advocate for there not to be gun control. I'm sure that they would have to admit that here you have a guy that lies about getting it, because people say, look, if people want to get guns, they're going to get guns. All this business about the registration of this, the registration of that, there are easy ways to be able to get weapons of destruction. Mass destruction also, but just in terms of destruction. Here, this guy did have a handgun, to answer your question, Kimberly. And for those of you that don't know, I'm sure you've all heard about the shooting spree that was in Aurora, Illinois. But look, you know, sometimes you don't even know why people do anything. We've talked about that on the show. Even his family has no answers on what led him to open fire at that warehouse, other than the fact that he was probably upset. He's losing his job. He had been on the job for 15 years. And who knows, some people get very upset about those kind of things. And he was only 45 years old, and now he's gone, you know, after killing five co-workers and wounding five police officers. Now, look, what led to it really doesn't matter. There's no justification for it, and that's really the bottom line. Now, they're reviewing and have reviewed, I should say, the Illinois has reviewed how it was that he had a weapon. And the reason that they were reviewing it is because this guy actually had a felony conviction. Now, if he had a felony conviction, where was the breakdown in the system? That's the problem. You know, we always say criminals can get guns, and the innocent people, they can't get guns. You know, we've discussed that on the show. Now, the governor of Illinois is looking into this because they figured, look, if he had a felony conviction, there's no way that he should have had it, and that he's recognizing that there was probably that there was a problem in their system of retrieving firearms from people. Now, people have these cards that they can get that gives them the right to be able to own a handgun, etc. Now, when those cards are voided, apparently, they are supposed to go back and actually collect. Let me back up. The reason why the cards get voided by somebody who legitimately had these so-called cards, the reason why they end up losing their privilege is when they get convicted of some kind of crime or a felony. So here they started out as a good citizen. They got them, and they had their card that permits them to have this handgun. And now, after they do a crime, we'll say, it doesn't have to be gun-related, something else. And now they revoke, their privilege gets revoked. Now, is what they're saying is that the investigation so far has shown that he lied about his criminal history in 2014 for him to even get that card in the first place, because that card permits you to be able to purchase a handgun. So the way it works is that there's a background check, so to speak, so you know, through the state. So then you end up in the Department of Justice. So you end up getting cleared, so they give you this card. So you can then take that card. It's called a firearm owner's identification card, all right? They call it FOIC. At any rate. So they give you this card. He's clear. Go purchase your handgun. Now, it's what he did. He answered no to a question on his January 2014 application for his firearm owner's identification card about whether or not he'd ever been convicted of a felony. Now, when they did a search, the search showed no prohibiting factors in his criminal history. So his card was approved on January 31st of 2014. He then turned around and purchased a handgun in March of 2014. Now, when he submitted his fingerprints as part of his application to get the concealed carry license, the prints revealed an FBI record and a felony conviction in Mississippi. Now, remember, he's up in Illinois now. So he had a felony conviction in Mississippi. Are you ready for this? For aggravated assault stemming from the stabbing of an ex-girlfriend. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison for assault and was released from custody in April of 1997. So now you're talking about a felon. He was in a different state, so what? It's the FBI that is where it was listed. And so you have to wonder, right? Well, let me just tell you. Basically, the only thing they did when they caught that, it only prompted a letter to Martin notifying him that his concealed carry application was denied and ordering him to surrender his weapons. Now, as what happened was that his card was revoked in April of 2014. Now, remember what I told you. He applied in January 2014. It was given to him, approved at the end of January 2014. So we're talking about April. because now he purchased a gun in March. So now in April, his card was revoked, and that the regular procedure the state police in Illinois said was to, they were supposed to notify law enforcement. So understand the process. It was revoked because they ended up catching the issue about him being incarcerated for aggravated assault in Mississippi. They revoked the card. He's already purchased a handgun. So the card gets revoked. And is what they were supposed to do was notify local law enforcement that his card had been revoked. The local police department had no record of receiving that notification, although they admit that it's possible that it was sent and the department no longer had a record of it. The problem is that because the law requires those who have those cards when they're revoked to surrender their card within 48 hours, and they had to document the fact that they surrendered whatever weapons they had. But guess what? Once again, they never did it. There was a form that they had to fill out called a firearm disposition record. It's not there. Now, Illinois, the state police said it. Look, they issued, if you're ready for this, in 2018 alone, they issued 10,818 revocations. Listen to that number. That's almost 11,000 revocations to cardholders in 2018. That's a lot of revocations. So you have to wonder, why were so many of these cards revoked? And they say in most instances, the firearm disposition record isn't returned. They never get it back. So nobody does the follow-up is the point. So now the Illinois lawmakers who support more gun control measures says that there's a flaw in the Illinois law because it does not mandate that police ensure weapons, you know, to make sure they've been removed if a red flag from the home of the person if a red flag is raised after someone passes a background check and receives the card. But they don't go back and get it when it actually gets revoked. Now, apparently, legislation along the same lines was introduced in 2016 to require police to actually go to the homes of gun owners who have had their cards revoked and actually search for the weapons. But they said the measure failed over concerns, are you ready for this? That it would overtax police departments. So you're telling me there would be that many that are revoked? Now, look, I'm an advocate of people being able to own guns and the rest of it, follow the system. But think about it. How many, if they're talking about overtaxing the system, how many individuals were they giving these cards out to? And look at how many they revoked. So you're telling me almost 11,000 people who got the right to carry a gun, the right got revoked in 2018, 1 year alone. What will all these 11,000 people doing to get their cards revoked? That's a lot. I don't know. You know, you guys know that my feeling about the CCWs, et cetera, you know, that they, you know, this business gets way out of line as far as I'm concerned. And people carrying concealed weapons, I'm not an advocate of that. But at any rate, I thought I would share that with you to give you what the true story about that was. So, Kimberly, I hope that answers your questions. Do I think that title controls are critical to our society? Yes, I do agree with that. But is what I'm showing you also is that, look, these title controls can be put in place. The politicians can pass whatever laws they want. But don't think ever that that's going to be a system that's going to be 100%. It's not going to be 100% because the wrong people will still always get a weapon somehow. We can't rely on that. We cannot rely on that. Okay, let's move on. Let me read this third email to you. Jim, after learning that you had written a book, Right to Counsel, I went on Amazon and bought a copy. It was really good, but after hearing your show, talking about serial killers, would you ever help a serial killer again? Mary, Wichita, Kansas. Listen, when you say help a serial killer, you know, for those of you that have read the book that I wrote, Right to Counsel, it's not a question of what I would have done, you know, what I would have done anything different. First of all, right now, the most direct answer to your question is no, I would not help a serial killer now. I was really kind of against it at the time, but I went ahead and did it for the reasons that are stated in the book. But, you know, and right now, there's no thought in my head that I would ever do it on at any level. As you also know, I was a police officer for approximately 20 years. I'm not an advocate of getting out there and helping criminals. Yes, I still believe in the Sixth Amendment. The book is about emotions. You even heard me talking about emotions today. I'm a firm believer that these things have to take the proper course. We have to leave the emotions out of the judicial system. But Kimberly, no. Today, I would definitely not help. I would have no intentions to help any serial killer in any way, shape, or form. All right? And, oh, by the way, thank you for having bought the book. All right, let's move on. Last week, we were talking about these male serial killers and some of the worst ones. Now, I will tell you that one of the ones that I wanted to discuss is John Wayne Gacy. John Wayne Gacy, he was a rapist. He was a serial killer. He was a rapist. He sexually assaulted, tortured, and murdered at least 33 teenage boys and young men between 1972 and 1978. Look at those numbers. And these are teenage boys. The reason why I'm singling him out is because a lot of people look at serial killers that is always, you know, the women and young girls. And this is one where it had to do with teenage boys and young men between that six-year period. And this took place, here we go, where? Chicago. Cook County. I shouldn't say that. It was Cook County, Illinois. Now, I will tell you that all of Gacy's known murders were committed inside his ranch house. His victims were typically induced to his address by force or deception. And all except one of his victims was murdered by either asphyxiation or strangulation with a makeshift tourniquet of sorts. Now, as his first victim was stabbed to death, by the way. Now, here's what's really sick about all of this, is that he actually buried 26 of his victims in the crawl space of his home. Three other victims were buried elsewhere on his property, while bodies of his last four known victims were discarded in the river, all right, the Des Plaines River out there. Now, he was convicted of these 33 murders, and he was sentenced to death on March 13, 1980, but for only 12 of those murders. Now, he turns around and spends 14 years on death row before he was executed by lethal injection in May of 1994. Now, you know, here we go again. You know, the appeal process takes so long for some of these. It really takes a long time. And because of the appeal process, you see when he's committed these murders, you see that he was convicted in 1980, and yet he wasn't executed until 14 years later. Now, again, with some of this, I'm always curious about what my listeners think about things. The death penalty is one of them. What do you think about the death penalty? 14 years, that's how long it took to execute this individual. Now, some people argue with the death penalty, there's cruel and unusual punishment with this lethal injection versus, you know, the electric chair, which some people, you know, that started out because they wanted it to be more humane than hanging, quite frankly. At any rate, I'm curious what people have to say. So you can email me or you can call, whatever, on this issue of the death penalty. Look, Gacy also became known as the killer clown. Now, you know, there's people out there that are really afraid of clowns. I never understood that, quite frankly. But there are people out there that are scared to death of clowns. They make these movies with clowns. You know, these. I think they had another one that not too last year or the year before that came out. I think it was called It or something like that. But, you know, but they called him the killer clown because of his charitable services at fundraising events, parades, and children's parties where he would dress up, are you ready for this one, as Pogo the Clown or Patches the Clown. And these were characters that he had developed. So he dresses up as a clown. That's why they call him the killer clown. You know, was that because he had a sense of humor? I don't know. But actually, to be honest with you, I'll tell you why. Because he said that it took him back to his childhood. You know, now that's a lot of young boys to have killed. And here's the other part. These guys are masters at sucking people in. I told you that some of them he got by deception. Some of them he forced over to his house. But he was actually a businessman and community volunteer. That's who he was. I mean, he'd been married. He had stepdaughters, the whole nine yards. So he had his own construction business. Now, that sounds every bit normal. He was even with the First Lady Rosalynn Carter on May 8, 1978, 6 years after the killings began and 7 months before his final arrest. So, you know, he was a community volunteer. But like I said, some of these people can be very, very deceitful. So I'm not telling you to be paranoid, but I always tell people watch their kids and educate their kids. You're talking about 33 teenage boys. How was this guy able to induce 33 teenage boys over to his home? Think about that. You need to have the education with your children about who to trust, you know, et cetera. So make sure that they get the education, you know, at home. You know, we've done other episodes on missing children, et cetera. It's sad. The other one that I wanted to talk to you about was the Green River Killer. You guys might remember that because it was all over the news. But his name was Gary Ridgway. He was initially convicted of 48 separate murders. 48. And then they did some plea bargain with him, and he actually confessed to 49. He was the most prolific serial killer in United States history, according to the confirmed murders. He killed teenage girls and women in the state of Washington during the 80s and the 90s, and most of his victims were alleged to be sex workers and other women in vulnerable circumstances. You hear that, ladies? Vulnerable circumstances. Don't be so desperate. You know, he even went after underage runaways. The press gave him the nickname after the first five victims were found in the Green River before his identity was known. And he strangled his victims as well, usually by hand. Sometimes he used other means to strangle. And then he would dump their bodies in forested and overgrown areas in King County up there, often returning to the bodies, by the way, to have sexual intercourse with them. How sick is that? How sick is that? Finally, on November 30th of 2001, as he was leaving his truck factory where he worked in Renton, Washington, he was arrested for the murders of four women whose cases were linked to him with DNA. See that DNA? That DNA is helping out a lot of people that are in jail, by the way, that shouldn't have been there. So as part of his plea bargain, he agreed to disclose the locations of still missing women. So he was spared the death penalty and received a life sentence instead without the possibility of parole. So here these guys get to escape death after they, in fact, did all of these things. And the reason why that is, once again, it's based on emotions because the police want to solve the crimes because they've got these folders that are filled with missing people. They don't know what happened to them. And then after that, you know, you want to be able to get back to the families so the families could have some closure. But I'm going to tell you something. They actually attributed to him, and he later confessed, to murdering at least 71 victims. 71 victims. You know, so when you look at this and this business where he's pleading guilty, they actually were able to, and the information that he gave them, they were actually able to find a lot of these bodies and also bring closure to so many of these different families. And you know, I'm sitting up here looking at the list of all of these women and these young girls. It's just, it's heartbreaking to even see it, to be perfectly honest with you. All 49 of them. Sad. Absolutely sad. But, you know, again, our society is not the most perfect society. We got to watch out for people like this. And I swear to you, I really don't see letting them get off the hook. When they kill that many people, as far as I'm concerned, line them up against the wall, whatever you have to do. So, okay, let's turn to the female serial killers now. I'm telling you, some of these women were a piece of work. Men, you know, let me give you a quick statistic. It's true. About 90% of all of the world's homicides in general has to do with men. You know, all of history's most notorious serial killers are men. And we always think about men with this. But it's not just men. There are a number of female counterparts that are just as deadly. And I will go through some of this. And a lot of them, I got to tell you, use arsenic as their deadly weapon. So the first one I want to talk to you about, her name was Eileen, And I'm going to spell her last name because I don't want to get it wrong. W-U-O-R-N-O-S, in case anybody wants to look it up. W-U-O-R-N-O-S. This lady was born in 1956. She killed seven men. I'm starting off light, by the way. She killed seven men in Florida between 1989 and 1990. She shot each of the seven at point-blank range. She was captured after a minor traffic accident in one of her victim's cars. So there's an irony for you. She told the police that she murdered the men in self-defense because they raped her while she worked as a prostitute. Now, what does that mean? They raped them as she worked as a prostitute. Maybe they didn't want to pay, so she got upset. I don't know. That's the only thing. So therefore, is it rape? Now, she was sentenced to death for six of the murders. All right. Let's keep moving. The next one. Her name was Judy, and I'll spell her last name for you. B-U-E-N-O-A-N-O. She killed her husband. His name was James Goodyear. And she killed her son, Michael, her boyfriend, Bobby Joe Morris, and potentially her boyfriend, Gerald Dossett, which they were never able to find out for sure. And she was also believed to have been involved in a 1974 murder in Alabama, an attempted murder of her fiancé, John Gentry, at that time. But she was executed. So she met her fate for the murder of her husband. She was later linked to many other murders. And I'll tell you this. She was actually the first woman to be executed in Florida since 1848 and was the third woman to be executed in the United States since the reinstatement of capital punishment in 1976. So she took the hard hit, as she should have. The next one I'm going to talk about is Juana, J-U-A-N-A, Barraza, B-A-R-R-A-Z-A. Now listen to this. She was a Mexican professional wrestler. She was born in 57, and she was known as the Old Lady Killer. She murdered between 42 and 48 elderly women and was later sentenced to 759 years in prison. She would beat or strangle her victims and steal their possessions. She was caught in 2006 and found guilty of 16 counts of murder and aggravated burglary in 2008. So she was another piece of work. But she murdered between 42 and 48 elderly women. Next one, Jane Taupan, T-O-P-P-A-N. Now, this lady was a nurse. Now, look, nurses are supposed to care about people. But she apparently killed dozens of patients. She was also nicknamed Jolly Jane. Jolly Jane. She confessed to 31 murders after her arrest in 1901. So this goes a little bit further back. But again, I'm giving you the most notorious. She would kill the victims with different combinations of medicine and chemicals and even climb into bed with them after administering the dose. Now listen to this. She was found not guilty by reason of insanity and committed to an insane hospital for life. After all of those murders, again, this is 1901. I think that's a little bit different now. Who knows, back then they really weren't into possibly executing women as much, but she killed dozens of patients, and they just said that she was insane and threw her in an insane asylum. Okay, well, the next one, Amelia Dyer, D-Y-E-R. She was only convicted of one murder, but her nickname is attached to the murder of hundreds of infants and children. Listen to this. She worked for 20 years at a place called the Baby Farm. You'll have to look that up on your own. All right? But it's a baby farm, so it's where they had a lot of these children. And it was suspected that she killed over 400 infants, which would make her among history's most prolific serial killers. She was tried for murder in 1896 and convicted. And guess what they did to her? They hung her. Again, this is 1896. The electric chair, I believe, didn't come out until the early 1900s. And that, by the way, a lot of people don't know. The first death by execution in the electric chair stayed in New York. The reason why they did it is because they thought that the hanging was just too vicious, too violent. But you know, killing over 400 infants, you have to wonder, how do you do that? How do you kill children? At any rate, Kristen Gilbert. Now, she was a nurse who was convicted of 4 murders and 2 attempted murders of patients, admitted to the Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Massachusetts. She would inject patients with massive doses of epinephrine, which is an untraceable heart stimulant. This would cause cardiac arrest, and she would respond to the coded emergency herself. That was convenient. She was convicted in 1998. She is currently serving a life sentence at a federal medical center in Fort Worth, Texas. So she got off and got away from the death penalty. They put her in. She's not going to ever get out, but she's still there apparently. Next one I want to talk to you about is Nanny Doss, D-O-S-S. She killed 11 people between 1920 and 1954, including 4 of her husbands. 4 husbands. I don't know why the last 3 didn't catch the clue, quite frankly. Especially number 4. What happened to the other 3? That would have been my question. But anyway, so she killed 4 of her husbands. She also killed 2 children. Her 2 children. Her 2 sisters she killed. She killed her mother. She killed a grandson. And she killed a mother-in-law. Now, I'm sure there's a lot of people out there that would chuckle about the mother-in-law thing. I had a great mother-in-law, so I don't have any issue with my mother-in-law. But this lady was known as the Giggling Granny, the Lonely Hearts Killer, the Black Widow, and Lady Bluebeard. Her main method of murder? Take a look under the cupboard, guys. Rat poison. Rat poison. That's how she got them. She pleaded guilty and was sentenced to life imprisonment. She actually died in prison in 1965. The Giggling Granny. I have no idea how they came up with that name. The Lonely Hearts Club Killer? Don't understand that one either, but hey, that's what happened. Now, here's another one. Her name was Dorothea Puente. She ran a boarding house in Sacramento, California, and murdered her elderly and mentally disabled boarders. She would then cash in their Social Security checks. This lady was called the Death House Landlady. She was charged with a total of 9 murders. She was convicted of 3 of those and sentenced to 2 life prison sentences. She died in 2011 in Cowchilla. That's in California. Anyway, at the age of 82. Now, this other one I want to tell you about, Miyuki Ishikawa. Miyuki Ishikawa. She was a Japanese midwife. Listen to this. She murdered infants with the help of accomplices during the 1940s. Estimates suggested she murdered between 85 and 169 people. The estimate that they came up with, 103 people. This lady actually sought payments for the murders. So she was, in many respects, a hired killer. Many of her victims, though, were deserted children, and she said her services cost less than raising an unwanted child. So people paid her. She solicited to kill to get rid of parents, excuse me, to get rid of children who and to approach parents who didn't want their children. And she would convince them that the money that it took to pay her was less than actually raising that unwanted child. Now, you heard what I just told you. What was her sentence? She only got 4 years in prison. Now, go figure that one out. Go figure that one out. But she murdered all of these infants with accomplices. They figure she murdered between 85 to 169. General estimate, like I told you, is 103. She was paid for this, and she received a 4-year sentence, if you could believe that. Now, I'm not a part of that, you know, to know exactly what happened with all of that. I might even do a little bit more research on that, to be perfectly honest with you, because I'd be very curious how she ended up with a 4-year sentence. At any rate, so those are some of the most notorious female serial killers. So understand, it's not just the guys. All right, there's women out there also. So guys, check your medicine. I mean, check your cabinets in the kitchen. Get rid of all the rat poison and the arsenic if you see any. It looks like that was those were common weapons. And well, and that makes sense because what are they going to do? They're not going to try to overcome a guy either. I mean, yeah, women are not going to try to overcome a guy. So what do? They put it in your drink. They put it in your food, whatever it takes. Be careful, guys. Now, look, I've had inquiries to ask me to tell me what are the percentages that any of you can be a victim of terrorism? You know, Jim, what are the percentages? I mean, this happens, but, you know, I mean, what's the percentages? Look, I'm not sure what the exact percentages are. I mean, there's percentages that are out there. But look at it this way. Give me a break. You get caught up in it, all of a sudden those percentages disappear. You just have to be prepared. Now, they talk about the Bureau of Statistics. They try to qualify that in the lifetime of somebody's, in your lifetime, we'll just say, what is the likelihood of you becoming a victim of some sort? They say 83% of Americans could expect to be victims of an attempted robbery, a rape, or assault at least once as an adult. So there's one little percentage for you. 72% of households could expect to be burglarized, and 99% of the population could expect to experience some kind of personal theft. There's some little tiny statistics. Don't know about the terrorism statistics, but as far as I'm concerned, one death by that way is too many. All right, you've been listening to Jim Potts on LA Talk Radio. It's time to close out the show, but let me remind you that you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/Jim Potts Author. Be sure to join me next week. If you like what you heard, spread the word. By the way, next week, what am I going to be talking about? I'm actually going to be talking about the mafia because they, my friends, were also a part of domestic terrorism, and nobody thinks about that. But until then, be aware, be vigilant, be safe. Most importantly, be a reluctant victim. Talk to you next week. Bye.
You're listening to Listen Up with Jim Potts, only on LA Talk Radio.